The ASA Executive Council often includes a student, an early career member, to help provide the perspective of the younger members of the ASA. About 10 years ago, when I was executive director, that student and early career member was Tom Roby. I don't know if you remember him. He was a resident, doing his residency at the Yale Hospital at the time. And he's now in Everett, Washington, as an emergency room physician. But I'll never forget that one day when in the office I got a phone call from Tom Roby. He was so excited. And he says, "Randy, I was just looking over the ASA membership list, and guess what? Doug Loffenberger is a member." "Doug who?" Sorry. And Tom said, "Doug who? He's just one of the most famous bioengineers in the world. He's got hundreds of publications. Everybody knows Doug Loffenberger. And now he's at MIT and he's an ASA member." He was so excited. Well, I had to do some quick digging here. Well, I found out that Doug grew up in suburban Chicago, went on to University of Illinois to get his BS in chemical engineering, and then a PhD in chemical engineering at University of Minnesota. He taught at Illinois and Pennsylvania before, in 1995, he came to MIT as chairman of the bioengineering department, a post which he still holds. Can you imagine being a chairman of a big department for that long? That gives you an indication of how good he is, and that's one of the largest bioengineering departments around, and I think one of the most renowned. They're doing some of the world-class work in many ways. So I figured I'd better get to know him. Well, as chairman of such a large department, it's hard to find time to get together with him. But we finally did, and we were delighted to be able to have Doug speak at several of our Boston local chapter meetings. And indeed, if you go to our homepage, if you go to the chapters section and go to the Boston webpage, click on the group pages, and you'll see quite a few of the lectures and videos that we have there. And he's got several of them. It's been a pleasure to hear him. And in fact, 2 years ago, he gave a workshop at the Azusa meeting. So he's been contributing significantly to the ASA, and it's a real delight to have him be our opening plenary speaker tonight on the topic, Humanizing Therapeutics Discovery. Please give a warm welcome to Doug Loffenberger.
Thank you, Randy, for that very kind introduction. I really love the ASA and have enjoyed the meetings I've gone to, local meetings, annual meetings, the journal. I read regularly and always very challenging and very stimulating. So it's nice to be among you all here. I guess this is kind of my home turf. Cambridge isn't that far away, and so it's nice to have everybody in town. What I'd like to talk about tonight, I hope, will be of broad interest, because most everybody in this room and your families are treated with therapeutics of one kind or another throughout your lifetime, times of crisis, times of maintenance, sustenance. And so I want to give a little bit of a look at what the state of therapeutics discovery and development is, what, in my mind, is the key challenge in doing it better, and you'll see what I mean by better, and that this is not unrelated to the things that we think about as Christians and what we want to do with our talents and efforts. So the title is to humanize drug discovery, development, and there's really two aspects to this. So one is very technical, and that is to put more human biology into the work that goes on in the process of discovering drugs and developing them to actually use in the clinic. So we want to humanize it by adding more human biology, and you'll see where that shows up and why it's so crucial. And then the other is, of course, more ethical, let's say, and that you want to do this as humanely as possible. And in particular, what we're talking about is the role of animal experiments and the role of human studies and the relationship between these two. And so increasing what we do technically by adding more human biology will actually help us in terms of how we most humanely use animal experiments. Okay, and when I talk about therapeutics, this is a very broad scope that I have in mind. So some might be your typical small molecule drugs that you take as tablets or pills. They might be biologics that you might get injections with. They might now be the things that are on the verge of genetic modulators. Everybody's heard of CRISPR. That is being proposed as a therapeutic. You might think of vaccines that people take, are given. You might think of cell therapies. You can't avoid on TV ads for immunotherapies now for cancer, stem cells perhaps for tissue regeneration. So I'm talking about the whole range of things here when I talk about discovery and development of therapeutics. All right, what's the goal of therapeutics? It's to ameliorate as well as possible the course of a disease that you might have some measure of health in a particular dimension, and that is problematic, ultimately leading to death in one way or another. And the therapeutics might be merely aimed at symptomatic relief. They might reduce the problem. They might mitigate it, or in fact, you might aim for a cure. So therapeutics may have their goal at multiple places along these curves. So when I talk about the discovery and development pipeline or process, there's multiple stages that are worth laying out. So in the end, of course, you're going to end up with drugs, therapeutics, that whole gamut that I showed you, in clinical trials, in human subjects, and then to see whether they should be approvable for use. But how do you get there? Well, you have to start over here on the discovery end to even say in a particular disease, a particular pathology, how should we treat it? Where would we intervene? What has gone wrong and what can we do to set it right? Sometimes that's very difficult to even know where the target for that therapeutic intervention should be. Once you think you might have identified that, how do you do experiments to test for how well you're doing it? How do you find good test compounds, vaccines, molecules, antibodies, CRISPR reagents, and improve them well enough that they should be able to go ultimately into clinical trials? And this is a very large decision about when you go into the clinical trials, and that's called development, and that's how you take it further. So it's a very long slog. And the thing you probably are well aware of is most of the things you take through that pipeline do not succeed. Okay, and there's many, many graphs that I can show you that look like this, but it's the curves of attrition that even when you've decided you have a target that's worthy of intervening in therapeutically, you might be thinking of on the order of 10,000 different ways to do it, different types of molecules of one kind or another. Then you reduce that by about a factor of 10 that are worth actually even testing in animals. And then out of those, you might have an attrition of another 100 to even take into human clinical trials. And on the average, out of that 10 that go in, 1 out of 10 might in fact succeed once you get through the clinical trials. So this is a tremendous attrition. And if you work in the biotech or pharmaceutical industry, what you realize is most of what you do is going to fail. And it's a very interesting kind of career. Now, a note along that line is, this is a reason why when people do calculations of why therapeutics can be so expensive, I'm not going to run algorithms for what any particular therapeutic should cost or not, but this is a big point of it. By the time you take even a single one of the therapeutics that's going to succeed through this, it's going to cost a certain amount of money, and I'll show on the next graph where that money goes. But then you have to multiply that by at least 10 or 30 because something has to pay for all the ones that didn't work. Okay, you don't get them for free, right? So when you talk about the cost of therapeutics, it's all aggregated. This is the one that actually goes into patients, but something has to pay for the 90 to 95% that you put almost as much effort into but ended up not being able to be used. Okay, so where does most of that cost get incurred? And most of the cost is incurred in the clinical trial. So if you take a look at how much money it costs as you move a drug through the pipeline, and it may take you 15 to 20 years. Time is also an issue here. It's not that expensive in this discovery phase and the in vitro assays and even in the preclinical animal tests. Once you move them into clinical trials, things become very, very expensive because you're talking about working with folks in hospitals and requiring the whole cost of the infrastructure in hospitals and so forth in long periods of time in care for patients. So this is a very important graph because you look at this is where the tremendous amount of cost is, and on the order of 10% of these will succeed, and 90% of this roughly will just go down the drain. Okay, but notice this jump here, that going from preclinical animal tests into clinical trials is then where things are going to become expensive and they're likely to fail. Once you get into clinical trial, these might be the typical costs, and so on the order of tens to hundreds of millions of dollars for a clinical trial for a drug. Okay, and then remember, you have to multiply that now by 10 or so for all the ones that didn't succeed, even though they cost just as much to run their trials. Okay, so a crucial thing then, if you want to even just improve the efficiency of therapeutics discovery and development, ultimately have more success, less failure, less expense, where is the critical bottleneck? Well, the critical bottleneck is here, going into clinical trials, where things become very, very expensive. And so it's the transition from preclinic to clinic. And the major part of that translation is either in vitro, in test tubes and dishes, into organisms, or from animals into humans. So that's the huge gap that's got to be bridged. That's where you fail, and that's where things become expensive. So moving from preclinical to clinical, from animal to human, is really the major challenge you have in therapeutics discovery and development pipeline. Okay, well, if you look at that success rate, you might wonder, why is it as low as it is? And a big part of the reason is that if you look in area after area, the general capability of animal studies to translate to predictive understanding of human diseases or treatments is not straightforward. And so you can find many articles about the disparities between what one finds in different types of therapeutics between mice and humans or non-human primates and humans, in cancer, certainly in toxicology, regulation, vaccines. Okay, it's in all these articles are pointing out is that this is really difficult. Okay, this is why it's so difficult. It just doesn't simply, straightforwardly translate from mouse, non-human primate, dog, biology to human. It's really hard. It's not straightforward. Okay, why is that? I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but there's lots of reasons. So you probably hear often that at the gene sequence level of genes that you actually express, wow, we're really, really similar to mice, and we're really, really similar to non-human primates and so forth, and that's true. But there's tremendous differences at the level of the actual expression of those genes, going from the chromosomes to messenger RNA that's going to encode for the proteins. Those processes are not nearly as strongly conserved. And when you get to the proteomic level, the actual proteins that are in your cells and in your tissues and in your blood that carry out communication, signaling, metabolism, and so forth, those are very different. So that gene sequence conservation at the gene level to the chromosomes does not translate to the same level of conservation in terms of the actual regulatory and metabolic processes that go on. Another issue is that, you know, human populations that are going to be treated are very diverse genetically. And typically when one sets up animal studies, you're trying to control as many variables as possible, so you restrict yourself to particular species or strains of mice, and so they will represent a certain part of genetic diversity, but leave a lot of the rest of genetic diversity untouched. Another part is the immune system. We all have immune systems, so do animals. So if you actually want to test drugs that are going to go into humans, and you test them in animals, the immune response is going to be entirely different in that response, and that's going to influence the outcomes. Some aspects of biology are very different, development, reproduction, aging. And then these days, if you hear a lot about the microbiome, that we all have bacteria living inside us, in our intestines, in our mouth, in our lungs, and so forth. Well, those are different between us and animals for lots of reasons, reasons of accessibility, reasons of diet, and they strongly affect physiology. So whatever they're affecting is going to be different in humans than in animals. So the point is that there's lots of good reasons. That's why this is so hard. Okay, nonetheless, it's really all we have, because you probably wouldn't want to just take some MIT professor's idea of what would be a good therapeutic and say, well, he thinks it's a good idea. Sure, I'll put it in me. Right? You need some series of steps of evidence to say, well, it's likely to do some good and it's likely to not do harm. And so how do you do that? And animals right now are our best way to do that. Okay, and that's why we have the FDA to make sure that the right kind of preclinical studies that give us the best evidence possible, even though it's really, really difficult to translate that evidence. So you have to do it. It doesn't work as well as you would like it to. So in the field of biology in general and therapeutics and moving from preclinical to clinical studies, you'll hear a lot about the three R's, replacement, reduction, refinement. And it basically means, how does one do the preclinical animal studies better? So we don't have to do as many. We can maybe replace them with something else, refine them and do them better. And this, to me, is a really good challenge for people in bioengineering and biotechnology and so forth. Can we address this? Can we address the translation from animal biology to human biology, and all sorts of good things ought to accrue from that? And interestingly, you know, in one of my favorite verses for why we do what we do, it's the same as the passage theme for this conference, and that's how I view this. If somebody's going to work on trying to do drug discovery more humanely, do it more effectively, then that's certainly something that Christians in biotechnology ought to be taking on, because God has given us the dominion to do this as well as possible. Okay, so that's all the motivation. That's why I chose this topic for tonight. Okay, and I hope you look at it and say, okay, maybe I didn't realize that this is really important, and it really matters to everybody, and it matters to Christians. So what are we going to do about it? How do we incorporate more human biology into the process? And for the animal experiments that we do, how do we get more information out of those animal experiments rather than just say, well, it worked in a mouse, maybe it'll work in a human, it didn't work in a mouse, maybe it won't work in a human. How can we get more information transfer from that very same set of experiments? So we can reduce, can we bring more human biology in and less animal biology? And can we refine for the animal biology that we do? Can we get more useful information out of it? Okay, and so these fall into two neat categories. Just for purposes of presentation tonight, what can one do experimentally? And this is largely here, incorporating more human biology using tissue engineering, and I'll spend some time explaining that. And with this, how do we gain more information, more useful information out of the experimental animal studies? And here's where computational methods might come in a field called systems biology. So bringing these two things together, I think, is really what you're going to see is at the forefront of people trying to humanize the drug discovery and development process in these two ways. All right, so let's start with tissue engineering. You may be aware of this field from 20 or 30 years ago where people said, can we recreate human heart tissue, lung tissue, vocal cords, liver, because if somebody has a disease or an injury, we would want to implant this. So we might regenerate a human liver because if somebody has hepatitis, they need to have their liver function replaced or their kidney function replaced or lung function replaced. So that's where this field got started. Could you grow human organs using human cells? Stem cells is a central part of this, and the right kinds of gene genetic manipulations and proteins and materials so that you might generate a human organ that could be implanted into a patient. That's where this field got started. But where most people realize now is that's not where most of its impact is going to be, because the actual implantation of organs will affect thousands of folks, maybe tens of thousands of folks, once it all gets figured out, and it's still really, it has a long way to go. But what if we also recreated those human tissues and organs outside the body, because then we could do preclinical experimental studies on them, that we could study what goes wrong in liver disease, and we can study what goes wrong in kidneys, and we could test drugs in lungs or test drugs in brain tissue, and do it in human tissues and organs is more likely to be closer to the a human subject situation. Okay, and so that is going to affect millions, hundreds of millions, everybody. Okay, so now much of the tissue engineering field says, aha, let's not recreate these human organs to implant, let's create them to use in the preclinical part of the drug discovery pipeline. Okay, and my colleague at MIT, Linda Griffith, is really one of the pioneers in this, and this was an article she wrote 15 years ago now, proposing that this would be important, and it's absolutely turning out to be. Okay, so what can one do? And a lot of this was initially funded by a large DARPA program, and so often the case, interestingly, the Department of Defense is always very progressive and blue sky and is really opening a lot of the doors. And have to give credit to them here, too. So the idea is, can you create platforms outside the body, and in them you grow using biological means of cardiac tissue or liver tissue or gastrointestinal tissue or nervous system tissue, and have it be human and have it have important functions of those tissues, and have it in ways that can be accessed, and you can give it various nutrients or drugs, and you can make measurements on it about what's going on at the genetic level and the proteomic level and so forth. Okay, that's the goal. And that field is moving forward. And so in some of this is the very early DARPA work led by Professor Griffith's lab, found different ways to create liver tissues and gut tissues and lung tissues, endometrial tissues, vascular beds, in ways that then could be done, you know, on a lab bench. Okay, human tissues, multiple human type cell types, and treated and examined. Okay, and there's been great progress. This is a paper just from about the last year or so, and the point of it is up to 10 different organs could be put on one of these chips at a time. So just run through them all, liver, lung, gut, brain, intestine, so forth, and live happily together for a month, which is a long experimental period of time, and have a lot of the proper physiological characteristics. And I'm not going to explain what these all are, but are they producing the right proteins and they're metabolizing right? And do they have the right kind of transport barrier functions and expressing the right kind of genes? So lots of tests say, yes, these 10 different organs can live together, talk to each other for a month and have the right physiological characteristics. Now, it's not to say you have a whole liver here or you have a whole brain here, but you have aspects of those tissues and some of the functions that would actually matter in a disease state and try to correct it. And also, can you mimic the blood flow between all these organs so that if you add some drug or metabolite, it goes in the right proportions to the right different tissues and is metabolized and degraded and so forth. So, yeah, this can all be done. In fact, there's companies now doing this. Here's one. This is in England, CN Bioinnovations, also Truth in Advertising. This comes out of Linda Griffith's lab. And they, pharma companies will buy some of these because then they will use them in their preclinical studies. Okay, so what does this look like? I'm going to just show it to you really quickly. So if you want to create a liver, a certain liver tissue with certain liver functions, this is what you schematically might want to have from in vivo. So that's what you grow in vitro. You have little micro-patterned wells where you have channels through them, and you put in the liver cells, and immune system cells, and vascular cells, and they'll organize nicely and carry out the right kind of functions of gene expression, metabolism, and so forth. You can do the same, for instance, in the intestine. And the intestine, you know, you want to mimic. You have these barrier functions. You can put bacteria on one side. You have immune cells on the inside. And across the epithelial cells, nutrients will flow, diffuse from inside the lumen. It would enter into the blood vessels over here. And so can you recreate that with membranes and the different cell types there? And here's just a photo showing. Here's the barrier between, this would represent the lumen, this would represent the other side. You see immune system cells crawling up and in, looking for the bacteria that might be there. So one can create, and these produce mucus, they have barrier function to molecules that should not get across the epithelial barrier. Okay, so you can start to create these, and now you ask, can we do something useful with them? Well, here is a problem that the pharmaceutical industry found very vexing. And it's something called idiosyncratic drug hepatotoxicity. Hepatotoxicity means toxicity to the liver. Your liver gets damaged, and that's really bad. And the problem was they could never find it, too many of these compounds, in their preclinical studies. It happens when they find it, a drug gets approved, but still in the patients, 1 in 1,000 to 10,000, they find that they have tremendous damage to the liver of those patients. It's very problematic, and some drugs have to get recalled due to it. You can't find it in standard animal or cell culture models. Some people propose there was a genetic basis or an immune basis, and many folks in the field had the idea that, no, maybe what happens is you have episodic inflammation. Maybe you have a cold. And so your immune system now is in a slightly different state, and that immune system then cytokines and chemokines affect the liver. They're produced someplace else because of where your cold is, but they affect the liver in a way that now when the drug is there with the liver in combination with the inflammatory state, now it becomes harmful. And that's why you can't see it preclinically, because how do you set up inflammation in a kind of episodic, idiosyncratic manner? So this was an idea that this is what this organs on chips might be beautifully suited for, because what if you created one that had liver and gut, say, and you said, okay, what if I have an infection in my gut? Now I'm going to have inflammatory cytokines and chemokines move from the gut to the liver, and then they're going to affect the liver, and now the drug interacting with the liver might have problems. So this is something you could do in this organ on a chip and study it very carefully. So, interestingly, your intestine and the liver is one of the most important interactions in your body, because everything you eat goes to the gut, everything in the blood goes to the liver, and they talk to each other very strongly through the bloodstream and the things that they both put in. So if you're going to create two organs on a chip, where you start is gut and liver. You might not have guessed that, but that's for pharma industry purposes, that's exactly where you want to be. So the model is, what if I have a gut and I have a drug that's affecting the liver, but it doesn't affect it much at all? But what if there's an infection in my gut and now it affects my epithelial cells? So now some microbial metabolites and some immune system mediators end up in the liver. Wow, now in combination with the drug, now it causes the liver problems. So you can do that. This is easy to set up the experiment. You have the gut by itself. You add microbial products. You add a drug that might cause problems in the epithelial barrier. And I won't go through this in too much detail, but by and large, where you find cells dying in response to the drug, it's when you've had the microbial infection. So you'll always see a strong effect where I have LPS is the microbial infection, DCF is the drug. That's the synergy that you see. And what happens is, when you see that synergy, you see all kinds of cytokine storm in the bloodstream. So what's shown here is all the sorts of things. If you did a blood test and assays for the things in your blood, under normal conditions, there shouldn't be too much sign of inflammation. But if you have something like a cold or another kind of infection, some things are going to show up. And in combination with a drug, then you're going to have this very, very strong cytokine storm that now becomes very harmful. And this is all data you can get on these organs on chips. You can study this in human biology outside. So now this is a very extensive recent study to do that. Say, okay, we're going to have a liver, and we're going to have a gut, and we're going to have inflammation and infections. Going to go to the liver, going to have the drugs, and we're going to see what happens on this chip. And you get beautiful results that you get things produced by the liver, it produces bile, the bile goes to the gut affects gene expression there, those genes go back, express proteins that go back to the liver, they affect the bile. So these two things are talking to each other just like they would in your body. Okay? These are human tissues doing the gene expression protein communication just like they're in your body. These can study the drug effects. And so when you go through this, you see that if you have the liver by itself, things are pretty calm. If you have the gut by itself, things are pretty calm. And if you put them together, their communication really in response to the drug and the inflammation really goes very strong, stronger than if you just added them up. As you say, if I have this and I add it to that, no, there's so much synergistic crosstalk. So you would never see this even studying human liver cells or human epithelial cells. You have to put together this whole functioning system of organs talking to each other, and you can do that. Turns out when you see some of these synergies of the gut and liver talking to each other and all of a sudden producing lots more of some of these inflammatory cytokines, these are the very things that are involved with things like inflammatory bowel disease, chronic liver disease, fibrosis. You can now study these things because you can recreate these human tissues and how they talk to each other. Interestingly, if you have breast cancer metastases to liver, often they'll become dormant. But if you have, all of a sudden they wake up. One of the reasons they wake up, we've studied with the gut and the liver, is, again, you have some sort of inflammatory process in the gut. Those cytokines go to the liver. Now in the liver, those cytokines influence the tumor cells and make them wake up and start proliferating. So the fact that you have a breast cancer metastasis to your liver, it's fine, it's dormant, nothing's happening. And then some kind of inflammatory upset in your intestines. Might be a microbiome effect or something. Products from there go to the liver and wake up the tumor cells. Okay, that would be very hard to study, right, in a human being. You can now study that in these kinds of organs on chips. Okay, and I'll end here on this part and just say, I said how the gut and liver interaction is crucially important. Now to add a third one, where people are most interested going is now gut, liver, brain. Because there's so much indication that neurodegenerative diseases, as well as other pathologies, are strongly influenced by this inflammatory response that goes on between the gut and the liver, influenced by your microbiome, your bacteria, your diet. And so now being able to have tissues on this chip that have, okay, we have our intestine, we have our liver, they're talking to each other, and the things that they produce will go to the brain, and now you might see neurotoxicity, neuronal damage, and we can now study these things on a chip. So there's going to be, I think, very dedicated studies on neurodegenerative diseases with gut, liver, brain chips. Okay, and where's the state of the art on this? Everything I showed you is just been published like in the last year or two, so that's state of the art. Where's it going? Well, we want to be able to put the microbiome in the intestine. And it's very tricky because bacteria like low amounts of oxygen, your cells like high amounts of oxygen, so it's very tricky to set up this tissue on a chip so that your cells are happy, the bacteria are happy, and they're living together the way that they should and can metabolize and so forth. But Linda Griffith's team has found a way to do that, and they can now control the oxygen in a way that they can grow microbes in this as well. The other thing, of course, is you want to be able to do genetic tests. So you want to be able to say, I want to study genetic diversity. What about the effect of this mutation or that mutation? Well, this is where stem cells come in and CRISPR comes in. And you say, well, what I'm going to do, I'm going to recreate my intestinal organoid from stem cells from a particular patient that have a mutation. And I'm going to see what happens with them. And I'm going to see what happens if I get rid of that mutation. So I'll go in and CRISPR it out, knock out that mutation. And you can do that all in patient original stem cells that you then grow up as intestinal organoids, and you can manipulate the genetics the way that you want and study these effects in, again, human tissue. Okay, so let me move to the computational part, because the field of tissue engineering for organs on chips is moving very swiftly, but it still has a problem, and that is, it's not the body. Even these tissues, the liver tissue has some liver functions, not all of them. The brain tissues have some neuronal functions, not others, and so forth. So it's not going to be the same. So you cannot simply say, well, I put my drug in my gut liver chip, brain chip, and okay, it healed the neurons. It'll work then in a full human body. You can't. It's still not immediately translatable, even though it's human biology. So coming from an engineering point of view, what you realize is that if you build model systems, you build test systems, it's not the observation of whether it worked well or not. You create a computational model that takes the observations you made in your system and all the key parameter information, and now you take that model and you create a model for the actual application that you want. And so you model your test system, and then you translate that model to the real system, and that's what tells you whether it'll work or not. That's like airplane moves in wind tunnels, for instance. So there has to be a computational aspect to it. So that's what I'm saying here. This is the organ on a chip. And you can't just say, well, I put my drug in and the heart cells stop beating. That's a problem. You take that observation, but you also then take gene expression measurements, proteomic measurements, metabolic measurements, and say, all right, what are the molecular reasons why I put the drug in and the cardiac cells stop beating? Now, in a real body and in a real heart, I take that model and I change all the concentrations and the rates and the volumes and the other things going on, and I say, aha, here it won't happen. Okay, and engineers are used to this. You're translating from your model system to the real system. One still has to do that here. There's lots of different types of computation to use these days. You may hear the word machine learning a lot, and that's the most important way people are doing this kind of modeling in biology and in the drug industry. And all that means is it falls in a realm of computation called data-driven modeling rather than theory-driven. Many people in engineering and physics and so forth are accustomed to this, where you say, I've got a hypothesis for what's happening. I think I know all the components. I know all the players. I know how they're interacting. I will write down mathematical equations for them, simulate what happens, and that's going to tell me. In biology, you really cannot do that except under the rarest of circumstances. You really have to do reverse engineering on it and say, I'm going to make a lot of measurements, and from that measurement, from those measurements, I'm going to use probabilistic models and statistic models and algebraic models, and I'm going to infer what the relationships are between some outcome and all the properties that affect it. So when you hear about machine learning, that's really what it's talking about. You're generating a lot of data, interrogating a system, and then you're trying to find statistical and probabilistic and algebraic relationships that explain what's going on. Okay, so on the computational side, and this is where my laboratory sits, and I'll take a few minutes and then we'll be done. Ah, that, right? Okay. Right. Took me a minute to figure out what we were laughing at here. Yeah. So this is in the category now of, can you take animal model data, animal study data, and get more useful information out of it, rather than saying, I put the drug in the mouse, it didn't work. Okay, therefore it won't work in the human. Or it worked in the mouse, therefore it's going to work in the human. How can you generate those kind of models? So what we're after is taking these type of animal studies, mouse, human primates, doing observations, measuring phenotype, disease or not, treatment worked, treatment didn't work, drug was toxic, drug wasn't toxic, and at the same time, a lot of molecular data, the gene expression, the genetics, proteomics, metabolism, and so forth, and creating one of those machine learning type of models that says we're going to find out the combinations of all this molecular data that explains what happens in the mice, and then try to take that model and translate the meager amount of human data and try to predict what will happen then in a human experiment. And the reason why, I gave you reasons earlier why animal biology doesn't translate immediately to human biology, and I have some specific cases here, just as the example I'm going to use. There's many chronic inflammatory diseases, colitis, Crohn's, sepsis, other types of things where they've been very intensely studied in mice, very intensely studied in humans. So you know all kinds of genes in mice that are associated with mouse inflammatory diseases. There's genes in humans, you know, that are associated with human inflammatory diseases. And there's very little overlap. So of everything that you see in the mice, fewer than a third are also relevant in humans. So if you just take one of the results from the mice, you've got a one-third chance that it's actually relevant for the human, for any particular gene that you think the mouse has shown. And in return, of the ones that are known in human, fewer than 10% actually can be found as being relevant when you're doing the mouse study. And so that's this lack of translation in a quantitative way. So what can you do about it? Well, this is what we're trying to do about it, is these are just various machine learning algorithms, and there's a bunch of different names, and those of you who are computer scientists, you'll be familiar with these. But basically, different ways to take the mouse data, relate all the different gene, genetic, proteomic type of data, and find the relationships between that and what's happening in terms of the disease or the treatment, and now take that same model and map the human data through it and predict better what's going to go on in human. And one thing that's important to note here is that there's a lot of machine learning going on in biology and the pharmaceutical industry, and for my money, most of it's not going to be very productive because of the way it's being used. Why is that? Because to do this kind of computational methods, you need a lot of data. You've heard about big data, right? Well, the place that there's the biggest data is genetics, mutations. You can now sequence anything you want, so you can get lots of genetic data. Just what mutations does somebody have? But the actual gene sequence is so far removed from actual disease and treatment because there's effects on the actual expression into messenger RNA and then the proteins, and the proteins are modulated and interact with each other, and there's feedbacks, and it's all affected by the environment. So you can use the most powerful machine learning methods, but if all you have is gene mutation data, you're not going to be able to take it very far. And so it's the proverbial tip of the iceberg. The iceberg, what's really important, is a lot of the data that's more at the messenger RNA level, the protein level, some of the functional level, but you can get a lot of gene mutation data, so that's what you throw into the machine learning, and that's only going to go so far. So a big part of it is what kind, can you get the right kind of data to actually put into these models? Okay, and just to show you that this is true, it was just an assertion. So you can find study after study like this where you look at different patient tumors. So this is data, if I remember right, for pancreatic tumors, patient 1, patient 2, patient 3, and they each have 20, 30, 40, 60, 80 mutations, and they're all different. In your pancreatic cancer, your mutation is going to be different than yours, going to be different than yours, different from yours. Okay, so the G mutations really tell you very little. But if you figure out where those G mutations map into the regulatory gene expression protein processes, you'll find that there's a small number of these pathways or processes, and that there's different gene mutations that map into this. And so it'll look like they're different patients that are wildly different, but they actually have the same dysregulation if you look at a higher level of regulation, metabolism, signaling, and so forth. So this is the kind of data that you want into these machine learning models. All right, I won't belabor this, but this is the way we're thinking about it, and in fact, the way we're actually doing it. So you can start with your mouse experiments that you're already doing in the preclinical studies, and you have molecular data here, and you have phenotypic data that says the mouse is diseased or not, or the drug is working or not. You build your machine learning model on that kind of data. Then you take your human test data, which you have much less of, and you see how that model predicts the human outcomes. And it probably won't do it very well, but you use that discrepancy to then augment that model and improve the model for human prediction. Then you bring in more human data and continue to augment it so that the original mouse model actually becomes better and better at predicting the human relationships. So I call it a humanized mouse computational model. There's many people experimentally trying to humanize a mouse, make the mouse have a little bit more human-type biology. I say, why don't you humanize the mouse model? So that's what we're doing. And just in a nutshell, it works really well. So here's if you just take the mouse data all by itself and you try to predict what genes are important for human inflammatory bowel disease, you get a small fraction of them. This is about the 10% that I said before. And with one of the machine learning models that we then humanize with a small amount of human data, we can generate much, much better predictions in terms of the genes and the pathways that are predicted to be relevant for human biology. And so this, I'll end, this is the most telling graph that for the mouse data, any prediction the mouse says from the mouse data that says a mouse gene is important in human disease, you get it right about half the time. If you take that mouse data, create the mouse machine learning model, humanize it with a small amount of human data, you capture almost 100% of what's known about human biology. So with a mouse, you get about half of it. And in this case, these mice are believed to be really good models for human inflammatory diseases. But you're half right and half wrong. You developed a computational machine learning model on the mice data, tweaked with the human data, augmented, humanized, you capture almost all of what's known now about human inflammatory biology. So this translation really has a lot of promise. And so there's a lot of problems like this depending on the type of mouse data you have, the type of human data you have. We're doing a lot of this now with vaccines because the vaccines, you can't really test vaccines in humans. You can test them in mice. You can test them in non-human primates. How do you decide whether that vaccine candidate ought to go? Whether it's HIV, Ebola, dengue, you name it. How do you know whether it's likely to work in a human being or not when all you have is non-human primate data? Okay, we're trying to do that same kind of translational modeling with machine learning that will tell us whether a vaccine candidate is likely to be more successful than an alternative with this kind of approach. So I'll end here and say this was the problem that I outlined, that the biggest issue in therapeutics is the cost, the inefficiency, and that's largely due to the inability to move from preclinical animal studies into success in human clinical studies. They generally fail. And how do we improve that? How do we humanize the process, bring more human experimental biology in, bring more humaneness of taking the experimental animal models, getting more information out of them that's actually useful to predict what goes on in a human by using computational methods. And by doing this, we may be able to advance the therapeutics industry in many ways that are beneficial for folks all over the planet. With that, I'd be happy to hear comments and discussion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Doug. And now we have about 10 minutes for questions. The guidelines are, wherever you are, we're not going to bring microphones over. We'd like you to stand up, state your name, speak clearly, and Doug will repeat the question then for the microphone. Yes?
Hi, I'm Anu. I wanted to ask if you heard about the interstitium as a human organ system, and if you're incorporating the interstitial fluid or interstitium into your system.
Yeah, the question is, some folks have proposed an interstitial fluid as an organ system of its own. We can represent whatever you'd like on the chip. And in fact, you can have, so for instance, let me just say intestine, okay? Well, what part of the intestine? Small intestine, large intestine, so forth. There's different sub-tissues. So you can decide what you want to try to represent. And if you think that's important to the biology that you're studying, okay, you say, how do I capture that? What cells do I need? What functions do I need? Can I assay for them and say, yes, they're operating the way I believe that organ is operating? So, yeah, I've not seen anybody do that in particular yet, but you certainly could.
One other? Yes, Jay.
Jay Holman. Yeah, you showed this wonderful little organ system that I never saw, the liver and the intestine and stuff like that. And then you pointed to the problem of the drug testing that only 1 in 1,000 showed that they had liver destruction. How do you close the loop? How do you know that this model is going to predict that type of thing? And vice versa.
Yes, great question. So how do you go from the organ on a chip, gut, liver, and the explanation of inflammatory processes on synergizing with a drug effect to in vivo? So the way that you do this is in the organ on a chip, you can say, all right, which combinations of inflammatory cytokines are required or are responsible for the synergy with this drug. So there's other work that's been done that we were in fact involved with, and you can try all sorts of combinations of inflammatory cytokines, and for one drug, these four will cause a problem for the liver. For another drug, these seven will cause a problem for the liver. So you can start to get these signatures of if you're going to use this drug, you've got to be on the lookout for this set of cytokines. So how would you do that? Well, then before you would be prescribed that drug, your physician ought to say, well, we should give you a blood test, and we'll actually be on the lookout for those inflammatory cytokines. And if you've got this combination, this is not a good time to give you that drug. You might be able to come back in 2 weeks or in a month, and now that's subsided, and I'll check your blood again. So that's how we envision closing the loop. You have to, you find out from your experiments what of the inflammation is crucial, and then you can measure that in the patient's blood and make a yes-no decision.
Okay. You had one over there? Yes.
One of the critiques I've heard for clinical trials is that they're not representative of the overall population. So typically, you know, white males are used in clinical trials. And so I'm curious if, and there's been evidence to show that women metabolize drugs differently than men. So I'm curious if you can have, male and female organs on a chip, or, you know, African American or white, or, you know, kind of diversity, level of diversity.
Absolutely. So the question was, what about gender, ethnicity, type differences that are believed to both affect disease processes and treatments? Can those be studied in the organ-on-chip system? Absolutely. That's one of the main benefits that I envision. So for the one, you can use cell types from genders that have the particular chromosomes and some of the genes that they'll express. Hormones are huge. There's been studies in these organs on chips that, depending on the hormonal treatments that you use, very different things will happen. No surprise, but now you can study that. Different ethnic backgrounds, genetic backgrounds. That's what I tried to point out about the stem cells. You can get stem cells from different patients or different subjects, different backgrounds. You can alter them if you want through CRISPR or other means and create whatever genetic diversity that you want and do it in a relatively high throughput way. So that is one of the benefits that's envisioned for the organs on chips, is the ability to study a lot of this diversity much more effectively.
Two more questions. Yes.
You're Mark Andre. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Your methods are, the organ on chip are really focused on cellular approaches to efficacy as data inputs for training in your model systems. What about in translating from animal model systems where you have amino acid differences in protein sequence to efficacy in a human system? What about protein structural information as data inputs into the training process, and have you found that that's as helpful as the organ base?
Yeah, great question. So if I can pose it right, it's from some of these in vitro systems we can get cellular tissue type of information, but what about things that are more molecular, biophysical, structural? Probably that's where that's going to fit into this machine learning aspect. And that's a big part of what we're working on right now, is what is the most germane information that can go. And so if I just go back one slide, I saw I was running out of time, so I didn't do this in much detail. But the point here is that there's other types of data to feed in. There's what you've done in your measurements, in your animals, in your in vitro systems. There might be things in databases, structure-activity relationships, immune system reactions. All that is fair game to be put in the computational model. That's exactly right. That I'm certain will make them more powerful.
Okay, one more. Who's got the last question? Yes.
My name is Edmund B. It's really amazing how you can model the complexity in vitro of different organ systems. I'd like to ask about adoption and how you can get companies by adopting this, and also from the regulatory point of view. What do you think the timeline is like?
Yeah, okay, the question is about adoption of these types of new methods. Well, the good news is that companies are very interested, eager. The FDA is very interested and eager. So myself, my colleagues, folks at other institutions that are in this field are very actively involved with pharma companies and very actively involved in the FDA, because everybody knows this is a problem. Everybody wants to solve this problem, or at least improve it some. There's nobody saying, oh, we're happy with how inefficient and expensive this is. That really doesn't serve anybody's purposes. So companies are already adopting these. As I said, there are commercial entities selling some of these organon chip devices, and pharma companies are buying them and using them as part of their preclinical studies. The FDA is involved. In fact, there's joint grants between NIH and FDA to study different of these organ chips with test compounds all together to see if they can figure out how much validation they can generate. On the computational side, again, both FDA and companies are very eager to incorporate this and say, we can take our animal data and can we in fact make better predictions using the models. So time frame, what I would say is whatever's available is already being adopted. Okay? Companies are trying to use this, and the question is, what do you have to do to convince yourself that this information, either gained from the organon chip work or on the computational models, how valid is it? Okay, so right now there's no thought that it's immediately replacing animals. We don't need animals anymore. But the idea is you can continue to supplement the animal studies, both with the human in vitro studies and the computational modeling. Now, your efficiency ought to get better. Okay, and now as you start to get confidence and you start to see relationships between real clinical results and what your preclinical data were, things will be adopted then with the increasing acceleration. So.
Okay, thank you.